Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
After the deluge, this is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Professor J. Cort Stevenson from the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science in Cambridge, Maryland. We're talking about ways to protect cities from the storm surge like Sandy, boosted by climate change and rising seas.
The other places that the most famous probably is the Thames River downstream of London. And the Thames has been very operational for quite a few years now. And it basically stops the surges that come off the North Sea and would have really played havoc with London numerous times. Now, that project is an interesting one because it's a big one and it's important, but it was not designed very well for the latest sea level projections, say, to 2050. So they're going to have to probably replace that or amp it up. They can over-rotate. They have big rotating drums that come down and actually close off the sea. They're massive, about seven of them across the river. And they can over-rotate those to make them stand up a little bit higher. Again, that's another project that's, you know, rated in the billions of dollars. There's a smaller project that I've seen also in Belfast, in Northern Ireland. And that one is a smaller project, and it really is designed to basically do the same thing. There's North Sea surges that are a problem there, and it's closed off regularly. So these things are not unheard of. A lot of it, of course, now depends on this new thing that we've got, relatively new thing, is not only surges that occur on more regular frequencies, but these irregular hurricane kinds of problems, these cyclones. So we've got an array of projects around the developed world. Even the underdeveloped countries, though, would like to have more tidal protection, like Bangladesh. The Dutch have been trying to really work out a system for that low-lying country. And it's about the size of Wisconsin, but it's about half of it is just about at sea level, and you can easily get a 17 or 18-foot surge in there. Sometimes it goes to 22 feet. So there's a huge undertaking there, too. So it's not only confined to the developed countries, it's also the underdeveloped countries, especially the ones that are close to the sea.
Right. And the Bangladeshis, you said, built some storm survival structures that could be of interest.
Yeah, I think the Western world just hasn't been attuned to this. I went through it's a huge delta. It's the Ganges River combined with the Brahmaputra, and it's a fascinating place. They have a national park there with the Bengal tigers in it, so it's a very unique place to visit. It's wonderful. But on the periphery of the park, there are numerous towns and villages, and they get flooded not every year, but every 3 or 4, maybe 5 years sometimes. So they've turned to outside help to actually construct what they call cyclone shelters. So when they get a surge up the Bay of Bengal, they can go up into these structures. And at least during, you know, a week or so when the water is really high, they can find temporary shelter. And then when the water goes down, they can try to resume their lives. So it's one of those things that it's a quick stopgap. It doesn't really help you preserve things the way you might want, but at least it helps the population get through during the worst times.
And, of course, many of those people are already used to living without electricity, so it's a little bit more of a low-tech situation than we had in places like New York and New Jersey. Now, in your press conference briefing with Mike Tidwell of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network, you and oceanographer William Boycourt warned about what might happen or what could have happened to Maryland and Virginia and the nation's capital if Hurricane Sandy had turned inland further south. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, we were worried at first that this thing might turn earlier to the west, and it was riding up on the Gulf Stream, and that's probably one of the reasons why it stayed as strong as it did. The Gulf Stream has warmer water, so you still have a lot of the cyclone being regenerated. Cooler water, the cyclones or hurricanes, as you can use those interchangeably, tend to dissipate. So this thing rode the Gulf Stream up, and if it would have gotten off the Gulf Stream a little earlier, turned west because of the front that was coming in, we might have had it in Chesapeake Bay. Now, it depends on where in Chesapeake Bay it actually enters, but if the tide surge on the strong side of the hurricane, which is your usually you think about it as your northwest quadrant, actually, if that wave enters the bay and propagates up the bay, you have a special situation in Chesapeake Bay where it's like a funnel, and the tidal energy that goes in through the capes gets amplified sometimes as you get towards the top of the bay, mostly due to what we call the resonance time of the estuary. And to make a long story short, you can really get, you know, a doubling of the wave as it comes up to Washington and Baltimore, which is where our population centers are.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Professor J. Court Stevenson. We're talking about what major cities could do to protect themselves from storm surges and rising seas in an era of climate change. Well, Professor Stevenson, let's look at Washington, D.C. If a big storm surge, say the 14-foot monster that hit Manhattan, if that came to Washington, D.C., what would happen there?
Well, you know, a lot of Washington is built on pretty high ground, but unfortunately for the national monuments on the Mall, most of those are pretty low-lying. It doesn't appear to be the case until you really look at some of the topography of the area. And when you really look at it pretty carefully, and FEMA has done this, and they're kind of aware that this is a potential issue, but we've actually projected one of the earlier storms, which is called Hurricane Isabel, happened in 2003, and Isabel came up and amplified the tide and had almost a worst-case track. If you really would have amped up Isabel's track with a little bit higher, it came in as a pretty low-level storm when it finally was at the bay, but if you amp that up, you get about 15 feet of surge in the Potomac right outside of Washington. So 15 feet means my favorite place to be in Washington, among the most favorite, is the National Archives. And you'd just about be at the basement of the National Archives, which actually kind of is frightening to me because a lot of our treasures are really there. But it actually could flood pretty wide area around the Mall. And, you know, I think that's a concern for a lot of people. The first reaction that I heard was that when FEMA wanted to reclassify the area, when they realized what kind of possibilities there were, and a lot of the people didn't want to be reclassified because these businesses would have had to pay more insurance. So they really sort of stymied the first attempt on that. I don't know how that is right now, but I know that there were thoughts about how to try to protect the Mall better, and I'd really like to see more action on that kind of a plan.
Could Washington and Baltimore be protected from a big storm surge?
Well, that's the question, and I think theoretically, yes, but again, it's just how much do you want to pay for what kind of a structure, and we really haven't studied the details of any of this, so it's really hard to say exactly, you know, what kind of construction we need and what kind of sediments we've got to really anchor big, you know, heavy equipment into, but, you know, based on some of the other areas of the world, it's definitely feasible. It's just a matter of where to put it and how that might affect the ecology of the area, which, you know, the Potomac is really important in terms of its aquatic ecosystem, so you don't want to really do anything there that would ruin the estuary. So there's a lot of environmental as well as just engineering considerations.
And what about coastal residents outside these big cities?
Well, you know, I live in a county it's called Talbot County. It's pretty high. By that, I mean my house is 10 feet above mean sea level. But we have a county that's south of us. About a third of it is probably less than 5 feet. And that area, actually, 1933, largely flooded in a hurricane. Didn't have a name because we didn't name hurricanes previous to World War II. But the 33 hurricane came in and wiped out a lot of farmers' fields for a while because it brings salt up from the ocean, and that salt really prevents you to crop the land for quite a while. So the farmers were really pretty much, you know, out of business for a while. So that's the historical information we have on that. And unfortunately, you know, they've gone ahead and a lot of those farm fields are now in houses. Now, it's not dense housing, but it is really floodable areas, and it is vulnerable. And since it is a big part of the county, I think a number of us are worried about what to do. One of the things that you could do is try to find the high spot. There is a high ridge area that it's almost runs in a parallel line that you probably could protect. But below that, you'd probably have to just talk about managed retreat, which just means you'd probably try to buy out or encourage people to leave that area that on a permanent basis, but they might have summer homes there or something like that if they were elevated. So, I mean, that's the kind of thing that we're talking about in Chesapeake Bay. Now, nobody really wants to do that because the American spirit is basically pretty independent and nobody likes to be told what to do where. So, you know, we've had a lot of pushback on that.
You know, I'm wondering, is surge hardening anything more than a stopgap measure? I mean, top climate scientists like Dr. James Hansen of NASA say if we don't reduce greenhouse gases very quickly and soon, the normal sea level could rise up to 3 feet or a meter by 2100. And that's like a permanent high tide even before you have these big storms. I'm almost picturing we may have to pull back from some of these cities and a lot of the current coastal line. What are your thoughts on that?
I'm totally in agreement with Jim Hansen's warnings, and I think if you're really worried about your grandchildren and 2100 and beyond, I think we've really got to come up with a better plan. If we planned it, if we continue to really use the carbon reserves and coal and oil and the gas that we've got, if the world really goes to that extreme where we decide to pump it all out and use it in the next 100 or 200 years, 300 years, yeah, we definitely have to relocate cities. There's no question in my mind that that would be stopgap. Now, my idea basically is that, you know, as we progress, you know, economists will basically start to just figure out how much global warming will cost in terms of dislocations and adaptation. And my feeling is that you start to really understand the balance of what we're doing in terms of costs and benefits. And at that point, I think people would have to start to reassess their energy utilization, you know, not only in terms of quantity, but where it's coming from. So I think we all probably should worry about how much oil we're really using and what our footprint is. So I would totally agree with Dr. Hansen's assessment that this is kind of a stopgap measure, but I hope that it's sort of like, unlike the rest of the world, Americans seem to be really with their head in the sand on this in terms of what we should be doing to really make these places survivable that are along the coast.
Yeah, I read that the state of Virginia passed a law expressly forbidding accounting for rising seas in planning documents. Is that true?
Well, I think you're probably more thinking about North Carolina, where the state legislature actually, on the Outer Banks of North Carolina, which is a very narrow band of sand that goes on the outer coast. It's a beautiful place, but it is very precarious in terms of sea level rise and surge. The communities there were actively worried about sea level, and a number of interests and trenchants got a law passed from the state legislatures, which said initially that they were going to have to reassess their assessments with the view that they were no longer to use future projections, but only past evidence of sea level rise to really decide where to put structures like condominiums and whatnot. That's been withdrawn. I think it was passed by one house, but not the other. And now there's a committee that's looking into the whole thing. But what's interesting, the scientists have a few seats on the committee, but there's also a huge interest among the developers and real estate people that tend to feel that we don't need to put any brakes on development anywhere along the bank. So I think it's one of those tragedies that has emerged along the East Coast. It's most of the states are probably trying to do something. I know Florida is, and I know Maryland has really been on the forefront, but Virginia has been a little behind, but they have a big naval base down at Norfolk, and I know that talking to the Department of Defense people that they are very anxious about sea level rise, and they've started to formulate plans on at least some dikes, polders kind of around the periphery of some of their most vulnerable areas already. So I think actually, Virginia is slowly coming around to the idea. I think that, you know, they're going to have to do more on that.
Well, I'm sorry to say we've run out of time. Our guest has been Professor J. Cort Stevenson from the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science in Cambridge, Maryland. Maybe we can talk again. I think there's a lot more here. Thank you so much for helping us out.
Well, you're quite welcome.
I'm Alex Smith.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
On the other side of the Atlantic, it seems like a different planet. Politicians, the media, and the broad public long ago accepted the science of climate change. Under the stress of depending on imported energy, Germany and Denmark decided to make the switch to renewables. In Germany, progressive parties like the Greens were elected. They didn't want to rely on big corporate power either. So Germany set a severe target to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions to just 40% of their 1990 levels by 2020, and they want to do it with distributed energy sources. Germany is ahead of that schedule. Daphne Weisham, longtime host of Earthbeat Radio, is now with the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. She traveled to Germany and Denmark last summer to discover how this renewable energy renaissance happened. Here Daphne speaks with Hermann Ott. He's a lawyer with the Wuppertal Institute for Climate, Environment, and Energy, but he's on leave while he sits as a member of the German Federal Parliament for the Green Party.
What is the strategy for the Green Party, first of all, in terms of advancing the energy revolution? Is there a focus on decentralized renewables versus sort of large-scale centralized approach of maybe more offshore wind? And how do you see that playing out in the coming years?
Actually, if you look at it, even our wind power, 70% of that is in the hands of private individuals. And solar, of course, most of it. And that's based on the, it's basically like the internet. I mean, the internet, the function was to be indestructible, well, to guard against nuclear strikes. So it was kind of set up not as a hierarchical network, but interconnected. And in our opinion, and that's also part of the green philosophy, first of all, it should be in the hands of the people. They should profit from it. And second, it's much more safe than if you've got large companies doing it. And of course, there's also kind of a slight anti kind of business root in there. So empower the people and not more profit to the companies. The result is, for example, the renewable energy law, which put that into concrete legal form and which has led to a revolution. I mean, if you look at the landscape in Germany, many parts, you see windmills everywhere. And solar is just coming the same way. Nobody expected it that fast, actually. Especially regarding wind power. And it also led to the fact that people have less resistance. If you profit from it, well, it may be a nuisance, but at least it's, I mean, I'm winning. That's a side effect, which was not intended, but it's, of course, also very valuable. And we conceive for the future a mix. I mean, there will be some large hydro, large offshore, probably large solar, concentrated solar power in southern Europe or northern Africa. But as we perceive it, this will not be the backbone. And it will be like, the backbone will be the decentralized. But as you know very well, I mean, sometimes plans do not develop the way it was set out before. So we don't know, really, but that's our idea. We doubt that the large concentrated solar power stations actually bring the results that they expected. We doubt that biomass can be used in the quantity that some studies presuppose.
In terms of the concentrated solar, and
right.
I've heard about some of these plans in the north of Africa that suggested, you know, one power plant in Morocco could provide all of its energy needs or something along those lines.
Well, not all of it, but 15%, yeah.
Do you doubt that that's possible, or you just feel that that's not the desirable approach to take?
It depends. And on the one hand, it can be made into a tool that fosters cooperation between Europe and Africa, where local people profit from it, and where actually, in terms of jobs, but also in terms of energy, But it could also easily be turned into a colonialist kind of tool to exploit our poor people in Africa. That is the other side of the coin, and the devil lies in the details here. We would, of course, like it to be an instrument for cooperation and benefit of the people in Africa, but it can easily turn into the contrary. So, but in general, our line is that we are not opposing it, but we are not actively fostering it, supporting it. Our main idea for future energy or electricity production is decentralized power. From wind, solar, some biomass, not too much actually, because there's a competition with food. But what's the main challenge at the moment is, of course, to get a grid fit for this kind of electricity production and to provide the storage. It's going very fast. Well, if I'm allowed this party politics remark, this government is not doing enough to increase the ability of the grid to cope with 25% renewables, and on storage is not doing anything.
If they were to do more, would it be in the form of, say, a smart grid, or what are you proposing that they do in terms of the grid?
Well, that's certainly part of it, but we don't only need smart grids, we need some kind of extension, not as much as industry normally purports. And there's a study that claims that we need 3,500 kilometers new high-voltage lines. But that supposes, of course, that all the renewable energies produced in the north, wind power, offshore and onshore, and it's consumed in the south. So you need lots of new lines. But the new green-red government in Baden-Württemberg has made it clear that they are now heading towards a sizable amount of renewables themselves. And Bavaria is following, which is governed by a conservative government. So there will be extensive renewables also, electricity production in the south of Germany.
Does the Green Party play a pivotal role in all of this, or is it really just something that has become so accepted by the general population, that the notion that we need to advance renewable energy within Germany? Is it being pushed actively by the Greens, or is it even taken up by...
Well, we are mainly connected with the success of renewables. That has historical reasons, and especially the Renewable Energy Law from 1998-99 under a red-green coalition that led to the boost in renewables that we have now. And we are also the political force that actively fights against cutting back the regulations that favor renewable energy. But it's also part of the wider society, of course. And sometimes I think that's exactly the reason why it will succeed, because people don't want nuclear. I mean, after Fukushima, 80% of the Germans were against. Before it was 60. Now it would probably be back to 65 or something. But there's a deep-rooted conviction that nuclear energy is bad, really bad. And for alternatives, you can't turn to fossils because they foster climate change. So there's only one solution, and that is renewables. And sometimes I think it is a small part of the population that is actually needed only to determine the atmosphere within a society. Mm-hmm. You have a bad example now in the US with the Tea Party, which is a relatively small faction of the Republican Party, but is dominating discussion. So I mean, it has got hegemony in a way, so that everybody has to relate to it. And a positive example is actually the relatively small part of the population that in the 70s started doubting nuclear energy, fighting against it, developing alternatives. And there was real freaks that went out in the countryside and lived on their own electricity. They wanted to be autonomous. And this made it possible to have a climate atmosphere now in our society, which is very, very pro-renewables. And that's why I think we will succeed.
So in terms of the feed-in tariff, do you feel that that was pivotal in the success of getting renewables to take off in Germany?
Absolutely. One of the most genius creations in legal history that I know, because it doesn't take state subsidies. It's the consumers in the end paying themselves. It provides prime access to the grid. The grid owner is required to allow renewable energy. And it provides for a long-term perspective investment security, because you know that for the next 20 years you get that return on your investment. And that was it in the end.
And it seems that quite a few countries are following your lead. It looks like Japan might be considering a feature for renewables, and India.
There's almost 50 countries, but most of them actually have a softer model, which has got a cap on the amount of money that is actually in Spain. I think it was $1 billion. In China, I know a guy who was in China, and he said, our renewable energy law made it up to the top in the Politburo, but then was stopped there because they were afraid they would get out of hand. Mm-hmm. They wanted to have it under their control. So they have got a softer version. But all in all, it's, I think, 50 countries now that have followed it, because it actually empowers the people, and it unleashes an investment. I mean, if you look at the growth rates in terms of gigawatt hours, you couldn't actually build that in conventional power. I mean, you can do it in China because they don't have any the environmental protection or the procedural rules that you have to follow, but you couldn't do it in one of our countries. So it's actually also a very, very active tool for increasing electricity production. It's absolutely clear that our present and our predicted energy supply cannot come from renewables, and it should not come from renewables.
Cannot come from renewables?
No, and it should not, because we kind of use any inch of the Earth's surface to produce some kind of energy, if you look at the projections. And one of the results of our working group in the Parliamentary Commission is that the rebound effect is extremely strong.
Explain what you mean by that.
Rebound is the phenomenon that if you have an increase in efficiency, cars and lamps or whatever, much of the increase is eaten up again by the changed behavior of the people. So you let the light burn longer, or you drive more kilometers, or you save money by isolating your home and spend it on a tour into China, or
right.
to Europe for that matter. And actually there's a phenomenon called backfire, where the emissions after the efficiency increases are higher than before. And that's why saving energy and using energy more efficiently is prime. So we have to look at those together. I mean, one is renewable energy. We need that. And it won't be too long that all the energy will be supplied by renewables, for sure. But we also need to make sure that we decrease the amount of energy that we use. In the Wuppertal Institute, where I used to work, we had this rule of thumb down to one-third. So if we go down to one-third of the present energy consumption and produce that with renewable mm-hmm. energy, then it will be fine, and there will be no competition between electricity production and food production, for example, which could actually turn into a major problem in the future. So renewables is great, but at the same time we need to reduce our consumption of energy.
That was Hermann Ott, a member of the German Federal Parliament for the Green Party. He was interviewed in Berlin during the summer of 2012 by Daphne Weisham from the Institute of Policy Studies. My thanks to Daphne for sharing this valuable insight with Radio EcoShock listeners into the way it could be, even in North America. Find links to follow up on all our guests and topics in my Radio EcoShock show blog at ecoshock.info. By the way, downloads of our programs doubled in October, going over 50,000 shows downloaded in just 1 month. My thanks to everyone who listened and shared our programs. The costs for bandwidth are going up. If you can help keep this ball rolling, getting some sanity out there, please hit the new donate button on our blog or at the website www.ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.